Hello, listeners. This month's episode involves two special individuals who are responsible for one of the biggest counterfeit busts in Secret Service history. The service was originally created in 1865 by President Abraham Lincoln to combat the trafficking of counterfeit currency during the Civil War. Although the service has grown in responsibility, such as protecting the president, stopping financial crimes, and combating cybercrime, criminal investigations regarding counterfeit still occur each day. The threat of counterfeit currency in the United States financial system has grown in recent years. Advances in technology, the availability of scanning and printing devices, and the adoption of the U.S. dollar by nations as their legal tender have exacerbated the threat. To counter these threats, the United States Secret Service focuses on strategic international investigations targeting counterfeiters and their distribution networks. The agency has also initiated a comprehensive international forensic counterfeit detection training program for bankers and law enforcement officers overseas. Now, please welcome Special Agent Rafael Barros and retired Special Agent Tony Chapa.
Welcome, gentlemen, to Standing Post. Would you mind introducing yourself to the listeners?
Sure. I'm Tony Chapa, retired from the Secret Service in 2008. My last position was at an assistant director, Secret Service, in the Office of Professional Responsibility, and was also the SAC of Los Angeles and the last SAC of the Secret Service Counterfeit Division. And also served in, I was a deputy assistant director in the Office of Professional Research back then. But I think we're here to talk about the position I had as the resident agent in charge in Bogota, Colombia. And we're here with one of our illustrious agents, Rafael Barros.
My name is Rafael Barros. I'm one of the assistant to the special agent in charge over in talent acquisition, which is under the home director.
Well, welcome again, gentlemen. I appreciate you coming on the show. I just want to say thank you. You are the first dual interview that I've had on the show since we've been airing this for the last couple of months. So again, thank you. So I kind of want to set the stage for the listeners out there as far as how you came into the service and how you ended up with the counterfeit mission, like going through the program or going through the service, how you both arrived the time before Bogota and working the counterfeit missions.
Okay, well, I can start and tell you, I retired after 22 years with the Secret Service. But before coming into the Secret Service, I was on the police department in San Antonio, Texas, and was recruited to go through the process when back then the Secret Service had a focus and a push on diversity, but also individuals' Spanish-speaking skills, and primarily because of the work the service was doing chasing counterfeiters. And I was interested in that, completed that process. The rest is history. Working in San Antonio wasn't my first field office. My first field office was Los Angeles, and L.A. had a big counterfeit squad and a forgery squad, and I ended up working in forgery because that's where they started the new agents, and we were chasing, back then the Secret Service was chasing the theft of government checks, which hardly, that doesn't happen anymore, but we were chasing the checks, and those checks were being stolen in L.A. and being negotiated in Mexico. And then from there, an opportunity came up to go to San Antonio, which I took, and the San Antonio office was investigating those checks that were stolen in L.A. in Mexico City.
Okay.
So I followed the case, from the chasing the mail carriers that were being robbed on the streets of L.A. to the stolen checks being negotiated in Mexico. And then from San Antonio, we worked the border and we started encountering these counterfeit notes that were coming across the border with the origin of Colombia.
That's one of the things that I've been learning about the Secret Service is it's never an isolated event. When you're tracking these individuals down, it always seems to cross state borders or even to different countries. So it fascinates me that once you get done with a case, it could have more connections to different locations.
Every case is an opportunity for another investigation.
So I was a police officer down in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I had done some undercovers down there with just mainly back in the early 90s. It was buying crack cocaine and doing the buy bust, the arrest right away. Came on the service in 98, and my first assignment was the counterfeit squad down in Miami, Florida. My very first undercover assignment, I was approached by a good friend of mine still. He approached me, and he was a case agent, asked me if I would do the undercover for a buy bust. There was a $10 note that was floating around in Miami. The target had supposedly about $10,000 worth of $10 notes.
So when you say $10 notes, we're just saying it was like a series, or it wasn't just one. It was
the bill was $10 denomination, all counterfeit, all offset. So I said I agreed. In the service, it's all voluntary. If you want to do undercover, can. So I went ahead and and volunteered. I thought it was a good, this was 2 months coming out of the academy. We decided to do the meet. It was, I think, a Burger King down in Miami. And when we started going back and forth, he had brought somebody else. So it was two targets and me. We're inside, and they started questioning me. They wanted to pat me down. It went back and forth. It was pretty tense for a while, to the point to where I was about to walk away from the deal. And I started to get up from the table. It wasn't going the right way. So at the end, we came to an agreement. Okay, let's meet in the parking lot to do the transaction. And all I had to do was look at the counterfeit and give the takedown signal. So as we go outside, I remember I think I was driving a small car, a two-seater, so we couldn't sit in our car. It was middle of daylight. They pulled up in a minivan. It was a sliding door of the minivan. So I kind of looked inside, and they're like, yep, it's the money's in the back. And I said, all I gotta do is just peek in, make sure it's counterfeit, give the takedown. Hey, good day, everybody goes home. As soon as I jump into that car to look at that money, they take off. As I turned around, I felt like this is not good. Sliding door still open. I pull out my weapon. I told them to stop. Right away, they're like, you're a cop. You're okay. We went back and forth. At this point, now we're driving. It was right off the highway. So he's already on the highway, on the shoulder of the Palmetto. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, rush hour traffic, and he's going 90 miles per hour. I'm not looking at speedometer. This was told to me afterwards. I am just concentrating on getting the vehicle stopped. My gun is pointing at him, so it came down to make a decision whether do I have enough to use deadly force, but if I do, then we are going to flip, crash. It's not going to be a good day. I'm on my knees, kneeling down on the floor of this minivan with the door open, going 90 miles per hour. Because traffic was so bad, he decided to exit on the ramp. As he's coming down, traffic was just too bad. Now he's slowing down. But what I remember one time it happened while I was a cop, and this is where experience comes in handy, is I remember a guy try to take off on me while I had a traffic stop, and I jumped in and disabled the vehicle. And that's right away that came back to me. And I just went to the front, put the car in park, and while the vehicle was still running, that transmission, I think it just completely blew out. Now the vehicle is disabled. The other guy's in the right front seat, he was too scared. I think he was in for the ride, and he didn't think all this was going to blow out of proportion. He opens his door, gets out without a weapon. I come out of the van, go to the back, and we meet in the back. At this point, our team is still trying to get to us. I don't know where anybody is. I just remember seeing traffic everywhere. I have my gun in my hand. I'm fighting with this other guy. It was bad. I looked over and I hear the sirens coming over, and I feel, okay, this is going to end good. A friend of mine, former Special Forces, and he's still on the job, and when he came out, I was like, okay, we're going to win this one. So we actually were able to make the arrest with nothing happened to either him or me, and that was my very first encounter with counterfeit as a very young agent. I think that paved the way to operations in the field. I think there were some changes, but at the end of the day, it was a good case.
Well, maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because you had talked about how the policy evolved over time, as far as you learn from these situations that occur and then you apply and adapt them. What I'd like to actually talk about is maybe from the history, from when the service was started, because originally it was created to help combat the trafficking of the counterfeit currency that was going on during the Civil War. And so I'm pretty sure over time, from then on, every time that an incident occurred or a new threat or a new way to create new counterfeit currency, you've always applied that policy to the next generation. Can you maybe go a little bit more into the history of counterfeit?
I think anybody who knows the history of the Secret Service knows that it was created to do just that, to combat counterfeit currency, not to protect the presidents. That came later. Back right after the Civil War, say up to a third of all currency in circulation was counterfeit. The counterfeiting back then, we didn't have photocopy machines. magazines, and a lot of the notes then were hand-drawn, and we had so many different notes. You had, you know, notes that were issued by the federal government. You had notes that were issued by national banks. You had notes that were issued by states. So it was very difficult for people using currency to really identify what a real note should look like. And from that point to today, when we bring new agents in who are going to be working investigations with counterfeit money, it's not how to identify a counterfeit note per se, but how to identify what a genuine note should look like. And over time, the Secret Service worked hand in hand with the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, sharing investigative data with them to help identify new security features in the currency over, you know, over 100 plus years. And that's why today, if you look at your notes, you're going to find the watermarks, you're going to find the security fibers, you're going to find the red and blue fibers in the currency, you're going to find, you know, three different types of printing in there. You know, if any of your listeners will take out a bill today, let's say take out a 20, and everything that's black on the front of the bill with your fingernail, you're going to be able to see that there's a texture because the ink sits on top of the paper. It's raised ink. And that which is green, like the seal, mm-hmm. On the bill is a more like a typographic, like the old typewriters of 20 years ago, where that image is pressed into the paper. And then you've got more like an offset printing as well, where you've got little speckles and stuff, numbers and different colors on the paper, and all to make it a little bit more challenging for the people who want to counterfeit the bills. 20 years ago, when we had the color copiers coming out, we found that there were a lot of people in colleges that were copying the bills. They would pass the bills to a little bodega somewhere in Miami. People wouldn't know what to look for, but the colors seemed right, so they accepted it. And those that were trying to make a more deceptive bill were the kind of people that the Secret Service focused on, like the case that Raphael was talking about, because those individuals were trying to increase the deception of that bill. The idea is if that $10 bill that Raphael was chasing probably cost them, you know, at that time, probably $3 or $4 to make, and then they sold it for maybe $5. And the person who was going to pass the bill was going to take the most of the risk because they were going to get caught, not only in possession of the bill, but passing the bill. But if you were the owner of a little liquor store and you took that $10 bill for, back then, let's say $3 or $4 carton of cigarettes and a six pack of beer, well, you lost the product and the change. And then when you went to your bank and deposited your money and they found that bill, you lost that $10 as well.
And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand. And I think it's the most common question. When I joined the Secret Service, a lot of my family members and friends would always ask that, like, you know, what happens? And I'm just, you're out the money. It doesn't have any value. You can't exchange it for anything. And so I always try to stress to them that, like, always check first before accepting, especially when you get large amount of bills. So, I mean,
and that is a history. What brings us up to what we're going to want to talk about today is why the Secret Service focused on Colombia. At that time was kind of like the epicenter of counterfeit notes, but it wasn't just counterfeit notes. It wasn't the notes that the college kids were making. It wasn't the notes that were being made domestically using an offset process, but a more elaborate offset process. The idea is that the bills will pass through several hands. And if the bills were accepted by the bank and then the bank made a deposit to the Federal Reserve, then that bank lost the money. Remember, if it was detected by the bodega owner by their bank, they lost the money. But if the bank accepted it, now the bank loses the money.
Okay.
And if you make a counterfeit bill that was so deceptive that the bank accepted it and deposited their money into the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve accepted it and then found it to be counterfeit, now the U.S. Treasury loses the money. So you have different levels of deception. And in Colombia, we were finding that all levels of these bills were being produced.
So that's a question. Is when these counterfeit bills are being made, is there a technique to try to get it to those different levels? Or is it, okay, because the way they were explaining it, it was almost like you could be deceptive enough to get it to maybe the Treasury, or you could be deceptive enough to make it to, you know, from the Federal Reserve to the Treasury. So I didn't know. So there's actually a technique that these counterfeiters would do to try to get it to that level.
Yep. And we had to learn that. Rafael and I and all the other agents that were going down there needed to do that. That was part of our investigative skill that we picked up as we found out what the process was. So if we were working with the Columbia National Police and they had information, we would help them evaluate that information on a counterfeit case. They may say, hey, we've got information that these guys are buying Venezuelan 10 Bolivar notes. Well, how is that significant? This was going back over 20 years ago. Those Bolivar notes were made by the American Paper Company, and the American Paper Company was also making the currency paper for U.S.
Okay.
So the paper had a great texture. It wasn't like something out of a magazine. And then they had to bleach the ink off of that. And so if their informants were telling them about paper and about ink, taking photographs of bills and stuff, then we could share with them the process. I said, this information tells us that your informant has information, maybe step one of a 10-step process, or they're in the middle of it. We can tell them that they're making a note that they're going to sell to gang members in Miami because it's medium to low quality.
Okay.
But if they're going out of their way to get special paper and special ink and a special process, then those bills are going to be more deceptive. So maybe a drug dealer that needed $20 million for a deal is short $5 million. And we know that these guys don't count the money. They weigh it or measure it and say, okay, this is $40 million. We don't have time to do it. And the guys who are doing the sale are short. So they're going to buy the counterfeit bill, put it in there so that it measures and weighs just right. The deception tells us for the other criminal act, what was the reason for that?
Fascinating. Most people, whenever they run into or meet or interact with Secret Service agents, it's generally a counterfeit note that has been passed. For example, I know I used to work in a movie theater, and it's been a couple times where we actually had to report the bill being passed when I was in high school. But I think to maybe paint the picture about how more in-depth it is, not just going to report to private businesses and collecting these counterfeit notes, it goes further than that. It goes across state lines. It goes over international lines. And you gentlemen were part of an operation that occurred in Bogota, Colombia. And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to invite you in, because I wanted to listen to your stories about how you gentlemen met and how the operations down in Miami led to one of the biggest counterfeit busts that we had in U.S. history.
Yeah, so when I was in the counterfeit squad, we were getting, in Miami, we were getting a lot of notes, counterfeit notes coming in from Colombia. So Tony Chapa was the rack, the agent in charge down in Bogota. So my first time I went down as a TDY, which is a temporary assignment just for a couple weeks. And that's where I met Tony. He had a great operation. It was starting to get off the ground with the Colombian cops. At the time, we didn't know if we could trust them, who to trust. We kind of leaned towards kind of getting them vetted, giving polygraphs, and then that way we were able to support more of the mission. I know that we had about 10 cops that were completely vetted. We had a couple great units did actually investigation down there. And if they needed our support, we were there to assist them. If there were cases that were tied down to Miami, we would be able to fly down, share information, and it worked out great. We would hear that there was a cave counterfeit plant somewhere in Colombia, and everybody, all the big-time counterfeiters that we would arrest will talk about it, but nobody knew where it was. Nobody could point it out or anything. And I think that was one of our biggest goals, was to find this cave, or if it wasn't true, then identify, hey, no, it's just a myth. And we embarked on that mission.
Yeah, it was definitely folklore, and looking at the notes, probably good to mention that at that time, how did we know these were notes coming from Colombia? The Secret Service Miami office was collecting notes. The New York office was collecting notes. LA was collecting notes. And when they would collect those notes, they would send it here to headquarters, and the counterfeit division, which existed back then, had a forensic section that was focused just on counterfeit, and they would look for forensically connections between the notes, and then they would give them a serial number. And going back in the early 90s and actually late 80s, they came up with a note they called 8094, and that was a distinctive note that came, and due to the ink and paper and investigative information, we took that back to Colombia. And as more notes were coming in, if you're familiar with the with subsets and mathematics, you know, that 8094 was the universal set. And then we were getting notes that had maybe the same paper and one factor that was similar, but it was a little bit of a change, maybe to make the note more deceptive or less deceptive or make it cheaper, but it was part of the family. So we were seeing the family of notes, these 8094 notes, growing. And so in the early 90s, the Secret Service put together a task force. They call it the South American Task Force, or 8094 Task Force. And they were looking for volunteers to go to Colombia. And they didn't know what they were looking for, but they were chasing leads. And as we got into the late 90s, if we were going to succeed in this investigation, we needed to send a group of investigators who were culturally aware of the difference. You know, working in Colombia is not like working in Mexico. It's not like working in Peru or Chile. It's distinctive. You needed to be able to speak Spanish and not like, you know, speaking Spanish, you know, like someone from Oklahoma.
No, it totally makes sense.
Yeah, and so we started building a team.
Gentlemen, I have a question about the 8094 counterfeit note. Mm-hmm. Is this something that has happened before where there was a task force that was put together on a certain counterfeit note, or is this a common occurrence within the Secret Service?
Well, the Secret Service has always looked at building teams. It's all about teamwork, whether it's a protective event or protective intelligence or investigations. And the Secret Service identified what was a significant note. If, let's say, New York saw a note and it was a note made off a color copier, chances are it's a local case and they would work it. But with the 8094, we quickly saw that these notes were being distributed and trafficked in large cities like Los Angeles and New York and Miami. And so they would put together a task force so that we could share collective information acquired through investigations and forensics and see where it would take us. In this case, it took us to Colombia. But there were other notes that the Secret Service was looking at. Other task forces were created, but in a much smaller scale than this. This was probably the biggest investigative task force following one family of notes. So the 8094 was like the parent note, and all of the other notes were the family of them.
So, gentlemen, over the months that were happening, as you were continuing to see this counterfeit currency coming out of Colombia, you gentlemen decided with your task force to go down into Colombia itself or Bogota itself and set up an actual task force in the location there. Can you kind of describe that and how you continued going forward with the investigative work?
We went from task force to residence, RAC office. So the task force was like precursor, and we saw that we had investigative data, we had forensic, we had a need to be there permanently, not just sending people in TDY, because we were losing continuity in our investigative leads. So the service says, well, let's create a RAC office, a resident agency office in Bogota. And that took a lot of effort, because you don't just tell the State Department that we want an office there. So we had to find office space and funding, and then recruit people to go down there. So when we all opened the first office in Bogota, we actually had to share space with DEA. DEA in Bogota, in comparison, if you were a DEA agent and you were looking to work your way up because of the drug cartels and everything that was key to Colombia at that time, the DEA office in Bogota was equivalent to going to PPD with the Secret Service. You know, you wanted to go there. So it was interesting for us to get there and see the intensity that these guys had in their investigation. And we learned a lot from them. You know, one of the things, and I'll give Rafael Barros full credit for, is working to help put together a network of information coming through informants. But the system, the process we used, I learned from DEA.
Yeah, and in the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, Colombia was very dangerous. It was when the guerrillas, paramilitaries, and the drug cartels was out of control. I remember living down there and hearing bombs go off. I was in my apartment and I heard a blast that shook our whole apartment. So it wasn't easy to get around. It wasn't easy to trust anybody. The cops were being bought off down there. Started to to meet and to deal with these cops, and most of them were really great. Some you couldn't trust because they were being paid by some of the counterfeiters, and we knew, we started to, okay, we can tell this guy that we're going to do a raid at this distribution center because he's going to tell the counterfeiters, and by the time we get there, we'll be cleaned out. But after a while, I think we really got a good understanding, and they knew the problem that we were having and what could happen if that counterfeit got into Ecuador and Panama. We made great relationships. I mean, they're just great guys. So we kept hearing this cave, where is it? So through intelligence, undercover work, a whole bunch of different techniques, we were able to sort of pinpoint up in the mountains that there was that could be the location. And I think we took like 3 truck full of anti-guerrilla forces into this area that was controlled by them just to go in and seize the counterfeit plant if it even existed. So we got to a place, I remember we were going through, we're in Bogota, so we have to fly to Cali. From Cali, we had to take trucks and cars about 2 hours up into the mountains to El Dovio. From there, we had to walk down the mountain into sort of a jungle type of environment, and we get to this farm. It was in the middle of nowhere.
Banana plantation.
Yeah, it was like a banana plantation full of just everything, and we're there hours. We're with satellite phones calling our contacts, calling our informants, hey, we can't find it. This is, are you sure? And they're telling us, keep looking. Is there? We're lifting, going through things, just checking everything. We're even doing a line of cops and just going down the hill. And we hear somebody, hey, we got something. And I think somebody stepped on top of a leaf, a banana leaf, and he felt something weird that shouldn't have been there. Felt like a rock, but it wasn't. So we started digging and taking off the plants and dirt and all that stuff. We found a hatch. It was like a metal, I would say about 3 feet by 3 feet metal hatch with a chain and a lock on it. We all gather around it. We all looked at each other. We cut it, took off the lock, took off the chain, opened it up, and it was dark down the hall.
It was just a hole, and we did what any law enforcement person would do. We got the youngest cop we could find with a book of matches, and we told him to go down.
Colombian cop. It wasn't none of us that went in first, but, you know, one guy volunteered and says, yep, I'll go down there. It was like cinder blocks with metal, like ladder type thing that you could just go straight down. And we kind of saw, we with our flashlights, I would say about 15 to 20 feet down into the ground. The hatch was not on a flat ground. It was on a mountain slope. When we looked down, it was terrifying because of where it was, how it was made. It was dark. We didn't know if it was flooded, snakes, all that stuff. Cop goes down there, and I would say about after 30 seconds, the lights went on. So we all started, okay, now we're rushing down to get in there. And what we found was, I would say, about a 20 by 20 foot room of cinder blocks with ventilation, with power, offset presses. They were intaglio printing presses, which is handmade by them. I mean, tables full of negatives and positives to make the actual plate that will make the counterfeit. We found counterfeit. We have, I mean, there was so much equipment and material that we could not believe it.
Yeah, it was, of all my experience, it was the largest counterfeit printing press that I had ever seen, and probably one of the largest that the Secret Service had ever found through investigative methods internationally on top of that. And as Rafael says, you know, there, each negative was evidence taking what was the 8094 into the different family. So we wanted to collect the various negatives that would then connect the bills that were showing up in New York and Miami and LA and all over the US to that particular printing plant. And that evidence would then take us to the amount of money this one individual had created over time. You know, first we thought it was $40 million. And then we said, well, no, this is more than that. This is the mother lode load of counterfeit money ever produced in the world of that level, you know, that kind of counterfeit. And like Raphael said, we took the anti-terrorism forces with us because the space that we were investigating was on the route of the guerrilla forces. So they had been out there weeks ahead of time watching the movement of the terrorist forces, find out when they passed through there. And we had spent a great deal of time looking for this hole in the ground, and we found it. But then now our cops up on the top are telling us that they're spotting the guerrillas coming in. So we're either going to get involved in a firefight, and of course we're going to be the premium for the kidnappers. So we had to collect as much as we could, as quickly as we could, get up and get out of there. And then the anti-terrorism forces were going to take a stand to combat these guerrillas coming through an area that they patrol, or we all get out. And that added to the tension, the adrenaline, the excitement. It was truly a danger for the people that were there. And it was myself, Raphael, and Robert Villanueva were the three representatives from the Secret Service that were there at that moment.
So what was the final decision? Did anybody stay there to wait for those rebels?
We collected all that we could in backpacks and jackets and pockets. And we had to get out of the hole. We had to climb the mountain. We had to go hike out to find a four-wheel drive vehicle to go to the base of the mountain, to get in a car, to get out. So it wasn't like we would be out of there in 10 minutes. To clear the battle zone would take us about 45 minutes, and that's running. So we knew time wasn't in our favor. So we had to get out. And as we were at the bottom of the hill, we saw the military helicopters were coming in, and they were either going to fight the guerrillas or rescue the cops. And in the end, they blew up the cave we found with explosives and then rescued our cops out of there and to fight another day.
So you generally were able to make your escape out of there with the evidence that you were able to obtain. What were the results, the final outcome from your efforts?
Yeah, that paved the way to so many cases that led after, because now we're identifying different families that came from the same printer, or he was very artistic. So he would blow up the positive of the image of the bill, and he would paint it and adjust it, and then he would reduce it to where the detail was so fine, and he would sell them to different people for a lot of money. So we started to, after, you know, the investigation was done, that paved the way to a lot of cases that came after. So this person, we were not able to arrest that day, but we knew who he was. The cave was in his property. Through informants and through investigations, we knew exactly who he was. We just didn't know where he was.
As Raphael says, and the information we got, was able to build a bigger case against him. We knew who the printer was. In fact, he had been arrested before by the Colombians and was of record with the Secret Service, but we weren't at that time able to connect him to the bigger investigation. Now we were, and now we had to find him. As we built the case, we made the connections. So this case was going in about seven different directions at the same time. We were connecting cases out of Miami to this guy. We were connecting cases in New York to this guy. We were connecting cases in Los Angeles to say that note started in L.A. So then they're chasing distributors. So they were able investigatively to take closed cases in some cases and take them up and start making arrests nationwide. But our focus was the one individual, the prime suspect. And as we built the case against him, and we were able to get the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami to file a case against him, because it is against the law to duplicate counterfeit currency anywhere in the world, U.S. currency. So even though he created the counterfeit in Colombia, it was distributed here, and the U.S. attorney took the information that Raphael and Robert and others took to indict the guy. So we had an indictment, not a find. So we chased the note, and we find him in Ecuador.
And this is in 2001?
I believe the arrest was in 2002, and this was when we actually found the cave was in 2000. So I think 2 years later, and I remember I was at the embassy and I got a phone call. Hey, I think we know where the subject is. So we called the international squad down in Miami. They were able to fly down there and picked him up, arrested him. He was extradited to the U.S. and charged.
And what finally led you to find him specifically? Like, because you're talking about when you got back in 2000 after the first event down in Bogota, or the events down in Bogota, you came back with all the information and started again with your investigative work. Was there any pattern or specific thing that helped you locate him in Ecuador?
Well, he was passing notes.
He was passing notes. notes. I believe he got arrested down there for passing notes. But the damage had already been done. He had sold a lot of his negatives, really, really good negatives, to a couple of families, which they took those negatives and hired counterfeiters to print. It just blew up. And the amount of counterfeit passes were just out of control. I mean, we were getting, I think there were two notes that branched out from his negatives that led to millions and millions of losses in the U.S. Once he was arrested and charged, didn't end there. We had to continue to fight counterfeiting down in Colombia.
Of interest is when he was captured by the Ecuadorian authorities, Rafael and others from Miami were en route there. They didn't know what they were going into, but they were going because the guy had been captured. I'm at embassy and I get a call. I think Robert called me and says, hey, they got the guy captured, but they're going to release him because they don't have the money to extradite him to Colombia. And I said, you know what? I'm sure I can get the money to buy the ticket to get him back to Colombia. And he said, okay. The Ecuadorians say, you give me the ticket, they'll let him go. They'll put him on a plane. We started this conversation with development of policy and things like that. Back then, the State Department said, hey, if you're spending U.S. dollars fly around Latin America, it has to be on a U.S. carrier. So I bought his ticket on American Airlines from Quito to Bogota. But it had a stopover in Miami. You know, we had a couple of agents sitting next to him. And when they landed in Miami to do the transfer, he was arrested there and was a guest of the Department of Justice, courtesy of the Secret Service, for at least 10 years.
That's fantastic. That's an amazing story. So after you captured the ring litter in Ecuador, what were the results from that after? Because like I said, as we kept talking through this, there's always investigations to happen after. You're never done, in a sense. Can you kind of explain what happened after you were able to detain the gentleman and what were some of the results?
Yes, he was arrested and indicted in the U.S. He was sentenced. Tony's time, I believe, you came back to the U.S.
In 2001, I came back and I came to counterfeit division.
And so I stayed down in Colombia, and counterfeit passes that we were seeing in the U.S. were still growing. We were still chasing whatever negatives, positives were made from that era. And we were able to actually chase these two big families that were counterfeiting. And they were selling the counterfeit to the guerrillas, to the paramilitaries, because they were buying drugs to support their mission down there. It was cheaper to, like Tony said in the past, put in $10 million in counterfeit, you know, instead of putting the $20 million in genuine currency. We were still seeing this huge amount of counterfeit, and it was really good. We knew it was coming sort of back from those positives, and we started making arrests through informants, through the local cops that we got to know better and better, to the point to where we, in 2002, I remember that we made a seizure. I think it was the biggest offset counterfeit seizure to date, and it was $41.2 million. That was a room full of counterfeit boxed up, ready to go to Ecuador and be distributed down there. I remember we got a plant from the same family. I think it was $26 million. And I mean, to the point when we were all done, we not completely eradicated the counterfeit coming out of Colombia, but we brought it down to at least 80%. It was just a great team effort by everybody. Support from counterfeit division, because they had to go and ask for money from Congress, the Plan Colombia era, all that stuff to support the cops for training, for equipment, better listening tools, all these great things. And I mean, I think it was just a great, great job that we all did down there.
Well, gentlemen, thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show to talk about the counterfeit mission to the listeners, but also to share your lives with us as far as what you've done for the United States and its mission to stop the illegal transfer of counterfeit currency. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the listeners of the show?
Just know your money. Look at your bills, you know, be able to self-authenticate the money, and you're going to look for those self-authenticators, the raised ink and the watermark, the seals and all that.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Carter.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Standing Post. Since 1986, the Secret Service has recovered approximately $929 million in South American-produced counterfeit U.S. currency passed and seized globally. So until next month, listeners, stay vigilant.